Welcome back to Highly Respected. I'm your host, Scott Greer. Today, I'm joined by very well-respected political commentator, Jacob C. Lloyd. Jake, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, great to see you. I saw you this weekend at the Million MAGA March. People keep asking how many people were there. Well, it's in the title. There were a million people there. Why do you need to ask any more questions? It was a million people. Why would they have false advertising?
right, exactly.
So there was a million people there, and both Jake and I were two among the million people there. What did you think of the rally?
I thought it was a huge success. You know, there was like a lot of different groups out there. There was us, there was like boomer groups, InfoWars was out there. There was, you know, the Stop the Steal people and all of that.
A ton of QAnon people.
But overall the look and the optics of the event were great. But what was most important was that we had a million people in the streets showing Trump that we're supporting him and showing the rest of the government not to fuck with us. Excuse my language, sorry, but that was the primary
friendly program. You can't be saying that, Jacob C. Lloyd.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I agree. I was very high energy walking around, and there was a ton of like normal like Trump supporters there. It wasn't just like this freak show carnival that some of these people want to imagine. There was a ton of normal people there just marching, very positive, very high energy. You know, everyone was coming together to stop the steal. And most of the people agreed, you know, generally with, you know, the general dissent and right on these views of the type of messages that were being proclaimed. You know, there was a main stage there that had a lot of goofy people who were speaking. Like Louis Gohmert, when I showed up at the main stage, there was like Louis Gohmert was like, hey, the German military had an operation that stole Dominion software, which I don't know how true it is, but he's claiming that, you know, there was like 8 million votes that were stolen through this software or something like that. And everyone was going crazy for it. It was like overall a very, you know, one of the more, I would say, positive events I've ever seen. I mean, it was like larger than any Trump rally that's ever been seen. I was at the inauguration in 2017. Definitely a different environment there. I think it was better than the 2020 inauguration. Mm-hmm. There was still like this hesitancy about what Trump is and what's he about at that time. And, you know, there was just, maybe it was just, and it was also better weather as well.
Right, right.
Which set the whole event. Like the 2020 or 2017 inauguration was cloudy. It was cold. I mean, it was January, of course. This is sunny. It was pretty warm November Saturday. And that clearly has an effect on people and being more positive versus, rainy overcast day. And as well as, but at the same time, you know, there was a degree of Antifa violence at the rally. I think some people on Twitter, you know, who weren't there began overstating it. They were claiming that everyone who went to the rally was getting attacked. They were getting beaten up and Trump wasn't doing anything about it. So somehow a few hundred people were able to beat up 150,000 people. How that happens, you know, I don't know, but that's what some of these people were claiming. I didn't really see that. Of course, there were cases of Antifa and Black Lives Matter picking off stragglers. They would find old people who were just wandering around who got lost in the city. They, of course, would attack them and, you know, vicious mob assault. But at the same time, those videos were circulating around and Proud Boys and other Trump supporters would then go out and try to retaliate for this violence against Trump supporters. And even when I was walking around, I was seeing more Trump supporter confrontations of Antifa. You know, if Antifa or Black Lives Matter was trying to confront them, you know, they'd be surrounded by 10 people and 10 Trump supporters and they would knock it off. And mm-hmm. People always want to like go into doom merchant mode with this and just like cry and shriek and like Trump does nothing. And at the same time, you know, if you're wandering around the street, I didn't really see too much of it. And when any time that I saw Antifa or Black Lives Matter try to confront Trump supporters, they were overwhelmingly outnumbered and they stayed quiet and they shut up and they tried not to get beaten up
right,
by Proud Boys. There was even at the earliest, you know, when their Proud Boys were marching there, and I think it was around, you know, an hour or two before, they pushed aside Antifa. Antifa tried to stop them, and then they just like shoved them aside. And so they don't want to look at these events. I don't, you know, it's, you need to look at and show the Antifa violence and how they would pick off like kids and old people to, you know, beat up just because of who they support for president. Yeah, you should highlight that, but that shouldn't overstate that, like, you know, all these Trump supporters are weak and impotent and can't defend themselves, when in fact, the ones who are capable of it, who are not, you know, senior citizens or children walking around with their families, you know, they did a very good job of defending themselves. And, you know, some of these left-wing militants got knocked out. So I think it's a little too much to go into doom merchant mode over.
Yeah, this event was a lot different than every other event that I've seen in that regard, where there is like Antifa involved and it's like a problem. I was at like all of the 2000, there was like a wave of rallies and protests and stuff in 2017. And I was at all of those basically, except for Charlottesville, which was kind of
really missed out, Jake.
Right. I know, which was like the one that kind of stopped the rally and protest culture and stuff for the right. And people are tweeting now about this event like, Trump supporters are being beaten to death in the streets and Trump won't even say anything. How are you guys? And these are people who, you know, were, you know, several weeks ago, a month ago, you know, still Trump supporters. And they're like, how can you support this man? He won't even say anything. And then he tweets about
he said a ton of stuff. Yeah.
He tweets about like
Antifa scum,
Antifa dogs are, you know, assaulting elderly people, you know, like what, all of this stuff. He's like really going in on it. And then all of a sudden these certain people who I will not name, chronic contrarians, they switch their tune and they're like, oh, so all he's going to do is tweet about it. And it's like, well, what do you want him to do? What do you want him to do?
Also, at the same time, if you got the police serious about it, they would more likely go after the Proud Boys who are like defending themselves or all the Trump supporters. You know, there's like several cases, even the one video he tweeted. I think the guy was like in a San Francisco Giants jacket. I'm not sure what baseball team jacket he had on. It was like a black
I think that's
jacket.
Right.
And that guy was like taking on 10 of them by himself. And they were trying to attack, I believe, a woman or some other vulnerable person. And he was like, hey, come mess with me. And they were all like moving around him and they were trying to like attack him as a group. And he's like clearly holding his own. And then he's walking away and one guy sucker punches him in the back of the head and knocks him out. And so it's not necessarily that he was showing weakness. Like that guy was taking them on his own. And there's a lot of liberals who were saying, oh, this guy instigated the violence. It's like, no, he went out to protect other people who were getting harassed and physically intimidated by these people. And then he showed them up. And then when he showed them up, you know, he turned around his back, he got knocked, you know, out. And then they swooped on him like hyenas and attacked him when he was down on the ground. It was totally despicable behavior and dishonorable, and showed that they're not willing. Of course, they're not finding fair.
Right.
But at the same time, it doesn't show like Trump supporters as weak, is that, like, you know, you just got to be careful about turning around your back to these people.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's. And then, like we saw on the night before, we were at Harry's, the bar there in D.C., and there were a bunch of Trump supporters. There was like a little trailer and stuff with Trump's name on it, and they were talking and they were waving flags and stuff, doing nothing disruptive other than they were just standing on the sidewalk and, you know, doing Trump stuff, singing, you know, like singing "Proud to Be an American" and stuff. And then all of a sudden,
MAGA song, yeah.
Yeah, and the cops show up and they start like pushing people around, and, you know, they're like, first they're just standing there along the lines, and then all of a sudden they're like saying, oh, you gotta go, break this up or whatever. And boomers are like, no, I'm not leaving, I'm not doing anything wrong. These boomers from middle America or whatever, they're like, I have a right to stand here. And so then the cops start arresting them. And it's like, this is what we're working with in DC. So yeah, like you said, if you made the cops say crack down on these protests, like, they're not going to do it against it's going to be us that are the ones getting arrested.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of these people were taking this to go and totally throwing Blue Lives Matter. And like, I hate police now, which, yeah, of course, what they were doing was despicable. But you have to realize is that police ultimately have to serve the politicians who order them, and the politicians are ordering them. And yeah, you could say, well, they should resist. But this is like you at your, you know, office job saying like, when they impose diversity training on them, you should go, you know, you should be shouting like the mantra, like, this is anti-white racism. I will not subscribe to this. And of course you get fired. So these guys, like, they're told, unfortunately, to, you know, they're unfortunately told what to do and they have to follow it if they want to keep their job, just like you and I, well, not you and I, you know, whatever the racist podcaster industry does.
We're employed by the movement. We are unionized.
Yeah, we're unionizing racist podcasters. They will not fire us. Big racism will not fire us. But when, you know, ordinary people are working whatever job they have, and there's a lot of compromises they have to make at the same time. Now,
yeah,
granted, that doesn't, people should not be totally slavishly worshiping police at the same time and thinking that they're going to always take your side. But usually those police officers likely take their side, but they, you know, like an ordinary person at an office job who has to turn the other way at diversity training and has to like deal with critical race theory nonsense. And when their, you know, boss is like spreading like ridiculous emails about, you know, everyone's trauma that they're having to suffer, that Trump won't concede or whatever, you know, you have to stay silent and just, you know, keep your head down. And it's this, and it's unfortunately the same case with police, even though in a lot of cases, many police officers agree with us, and police officers are really the thin blue line against chaos and disorder in many of these cities.
Right.
So I think people just, you know, yes, the police will do this if the politicians order them to do this. But at the same time, you shouldn't turn into just hating the police officer as an individual. You have to direct your anger towards the politicians who are ordering them. And at the same time, you need to have a more realistic comprehension of what police are and what are they doing in this situation.
Right. What I would say to people who, you know, that like the, you know, the back of the blue, thin blue line people is just when you go, for example, because like what, you know, one thing that I was like interested in over this weekend was just seeing like all of these people from middle America in this, like this hub of like cosmopolitan, you know, America, or, you know, I guess everywhere else too. And it's like, you have to understand that when you're in these cities, like these police are not like, they're not like your local sheriff's department. They're not like your local police department in your small town, or even in, you know, even in like Louisville, Kentucky, or wherever, you know, wherever you might be from. It's different. It is different, and it is much more political. And so, again, like you're saying, that's not to say that you should just automatically hate these people. But what I saw was like boomers being arrested for just not really doing anything, just not obeying them when they say go away. And then so these people get arrested, and then the cops are like telling everybody else to leave, and the people are like leaving as the cops have told them to leave, and they're like, thank you for protecting us. We love you. We back you. We're with you and stuff. It's like, don't do that. Don't like grovel before them while they're doing something wrong to you. But that's what I would say.
Yeah, no, I agree. And one of the differences I saw between the inauguration and this is that the level of violence in our country has certainly escalated since 2017. I remember how people thought it was so serious when people were coming out of Trump supporters were coming out of inauguration gala or some sort. During that weekend in 2017, there was these Antifa who were blocking off a sidewalk and were like, fascists walk in the dirt, fascists walk in the dirt. And so all these like middle-aged people had to awkwardly walk around them in the dirt. And it was like a humiliation ritual, but it wasn't necessarily them attacking them and physically assaulting them, which they have moved to that position since then. And even if, you know, I don't know if you went to the deplorable, but you know, there was kind of a fairly intense Antifa, you know, disturbance outside. But even that kind of violence is, you know, something, it's just such a regular occurrence now that we no longer bat an eye to it. I remember that I walked down the street on the Friday, you know, it was a few hours after the inaugurations, and they set off a limo on fire, and there was a few scuffles. But outside the torch limo, you know, I mean, we didn't necessarily have a torch limo, but they were trying to set restaurants on fire. I mean, they were shooting fireworks into restaurants and at patrons who were doing this, which, you know, in 2017, that would have been unthinkable.
Right. I remember the torch limo event because it was a Muslim, and that was a huge thing. They were like, these liberals are torching Muslim limos.
This was what Washington, D.C. was like in 2017, and now in 2020. you know, there's a definitely a higher degree of violence that's accepted and tolerated by the left versus the, you know, what they were willing to accept in 2017. And people were all over the place condemning the violence in, at the 2017 inauguration. And people were like, oh, how could this happen in America? And now we see it on a daily basis throughout America and in the most random places in the country, such as Kenosha and others you wouldn't have expected to be flashpoints in our culture war.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think that the violence, it's very obvious that it has escalated and stuff. I'm very pleased though, to see the way that this past rally went for us, that it went on our side. There was much less, even though, you know, with these sporadic little squabbles that certain groups had with Antifa on the side, overall, like the actual protest, the actual march itself, didn't feel this need to engage with them. Like in 2017, at the ones that I went to, there was kind of like this want. It was like not just a desire to go out into the streets and like make your presence known, but it was also like saying Antifa is going to mess with us and then we're going to fight them and we're going to win, to like, you know, punish them and make them go away and that kind of stuff. And it clearly did not work. And so at this one, I didn't really see any desire or anybody talking about like, we're going to, you know, show these Antifa scum who's boss or anything like that. It really wasn't about that. And so that was not at all like a centerpiece of this event.
Yeah, no, I saw that. And earlier I was talking about people who would go out and retaliate. But in the case of that, it was that Antifa was actually attacking them, right, or they were attacking people that they saw and they went in and ended that, put an end to it. So it wasn't necessarily that everyone came into DC for the purpose of fighting Antifa. They came to DC for the purpose of rallying for Donald Trump. And I think this does show that there's a long lasting movement that's there with Trump movement, that it's whatever happens with the election, with the final election results, is that this is not going away. The Trump moment is going to continue, and that the GOP establishment, which we'll talk about in a little bit, who want this to, you know, return back to Paul Ryanism and return to the pre-Trump days, that's not going to happen. And at the same time, when I was like seeing this like massive turnout on a week's notice, and I was thinking to myself, is like, could you imagine any other politician, you know, especially within the Republican Party, generating this type of enthusiasm and drawing this many people to Washington, D.C. on just a week's notice? Could you ever see that? And that's like another thing where people like, oh, well, we're going to have Trumpism without Trump. And it's like, how? Like, look at this. Look at this million MAGA march. Like, do you think Josh Hawley is going to inspire the million multiracial, multiethnic, post-liberal working class march? No, he's not. Like, this can only really happen with Trump. And people who are eager to discard him and to move on to something else need to acknowledge that.
Yeah, there's no way that anybody else could do this. What those people, the people talking about Hawley and this stuff, is they need to understand that Trumpism is about Trump, at least right now. We need Trump to keep pushing this forward because he's the one that inspired people in 2015 and 2016. He's the one that's been doing it so long. There was nobody else doing this. There is nobody else that's able to draw these crowds now, and there won't be for a long time, I don't think. The energy is clearly with Trump. It's not with Hawley. Nobody cares. Furthermore, nobody cares about what these people are saying. Even it's mostly about the Trump personality, but nobody even cares what Hawley and these other types are saying as far as, like, you know, their multi-ethnic working class stuff. No, nobody cares. It's like boring. Nobody cares, and it's not real.
That's exactly right. And, you know, moving on to a slightly different subject, and it's about Trump's base, is a lot of people keep saying Trump lost his core supporters this election, but that's not what the data shows. According to the same exit polls, right-wing critics uphold to bash Trump, you know, the people who keep putting 5% in their handle, Trump support among whites increased from 57% to 58% this year, and his support among non-college educated whites increased from 66% to 67%. You know, Jake is actually part of that demographic. He, unlike the libtards, did not go to college. What happened is that third-party voters went for Biden this year, which explains how Trump went from slightly winning college-educated whites to slightly losing them. So are Gary Johnson and Jill Stein voters really Trump's base?
Yeah, you know, when Trump won the election, everybody thought, wow, thank God that he was able to woo Green Party members and libertarians. Trump was just so good on the environment, and he was so good on limited government and the NAP that he just wooed all. Yeah, no, of course not. It's a ridiculous thing to say. It's absolutely absurd. There's no explanation. You know, there's no reason to believe that these people are in any way Trump's primary base, or that we need them, or that we should expect to have them going forward. There should be no expectation of having these losers, frankly.
Yeah, and a lot of them are these affluent types who are living in like suburbs or an urban area who don't really share any of our opinions. They may have voted Republican in the past. Well, nobody in the Green Party would have. But some of these people who voted for Gary Johnson would have probably voted for Republicans in the past. And now they don't, because they think that Trump is a xenophobe and a racist, and they want him to start more wars, and they want unrestricted free trade, and this is what they want from a Republican, and he no longer offers that. It's like, and you can see like the type of people who are like representative of the ones who are leaving the Republican Party, and all of them are, you know, folks who are like Paul Ryan. They just want to focus on business interests and you know, spreading democracy all over the world, which Trump is not about. And they want unrestricted immigration as well. So this isn't really some, you know, super nationalist, working class, populist demographic that punished Trump for failing to achieve his 2016 agenda. These are people who were repulsed by his 2016 agenda, and now they felt that Trump could actually win again, so they voted for Biden. And some of these people, and a lot of people are really, you know, honing in on how he somehow lost the white working class vote. And, you know, I think it was Ryan Gerdusky on Twitter who was focusing in on the Georgia race, and he was showing that he was losing among rural voters and white working class. That went 1% in the direction of Biden, but he still won them by a large margin. But at the same time, in the same data he was showing, is that like affluent whites and suburban whites went like 5% and 7% in the direction of Biden. And it's a little bit too much to focus on this 1%. I mean, that 1% likely voted third party in 2016. They never liked Trump. And they just decided like, well, like in 2016, I thought he could never win. Now I'm going to vote against him because I think he can win. So, I mean, there is like an issue there of like, how do Republicans or somebody who's like Trump win, you know, presidential elections where it is just like two party choice, you know, no one's bothering to waste their vote with third parties. And how does he convince them, you know, or some of them to move to his side, or, you know, whatever in that regard. But I think it's, you know, the people who are all making this argument demand that, you know, Trump double down on the populism and the nationalism, which I'm all for, but that message was already getting loud and clear to these people. I mean, and if they turned on the media, they would see that Trump is locking up all these poor immigrant kids in cages, and he's shutting down refugee admissions, and he's doing all these terrible things on immigration and foreign policy. Oh, he's trying to pull our troops out from Afghanistan. Oh, no, he can't do that. So it's, none of these people would have voted against him because they felt that he didn't do enough on the promises he made in 2016. Of course, he should have done more to achieve those promises, but I think all those voters who gravitated towards Trump because of what he said in 2016 were resolutely behind him in 2020, with some exceptions of people on Twitter who imagine that they represent far more people than they claim to be.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that if Trump had really not, if he were so far off of the mark from where he said that he was going to do in 2016, I don't think that he would have had the massive turnout and the massive support that he had from his base. I think that if it were really so true that he was, you know, ignoring his promises so much, I think that we would have seen a far bigger shift away from him than what we saw. And I think that the shift that we did see, like you've explained, is very easily explained by these other things. You know, there's, what people need to stop doing is stop comparing this election as if it's like a one for one exactly like 2016. It's not. There's a lot of different factors, like you've mentioned. The people who maybe voted Republican, they didn't think that he could win, and now they realize that he could, and they say, oh, you know, he actually could win, and I'm actually not a big fan of what he's doing. He's actually, you know, pulling troops out of the Middle East, or he's immigration, whatever the case may be, and so then they actually do it. So I think that those can be explained away much, much easier, and that it's not something that we would have even if he were doing a perfect job. These are not people that we would have on our side.
Yeah, I mean, he could have done a little bit more to appeal to white voters in general. I mean,
right.
You know, rather than focusing on the Black Platinum plan, but, you know, that ignores the bigger issues of the, you know, the dubious election process that this was under, that, you know, looking at like Mark Zuckerberg spending $400 million to set up election administrators who would go around and help people fill out ballots and all this stuff. It's like, yeah, maybe there was, you know, maybe we should look at that stuff rather than trying to blame like Trump for not doing enough to appeal to the white working class, which at the end of the race, he was doing everything possible to appeal to his core constituents. And, you know, with the exception of the Black Platinum plan. So it's a little too much. It's a little, you know, disingenuous to claim, you know, that this is the factor in the race. And you right. also have to look at coronavirus, is that this had such a devastating toll on our economy that a lot of people would have just said, and the media spent the last 7 or 8 months always blaming Trump for this, that this was all Trump's fault, that this is all Trump's fault. If they turned on the nightly news, Trump is responsible for this. Trump is why you lost your job. Trump is why you can't go outside. If we had anybody else besides Trump, you would be living normally. You wouldn't even be wearing a mask for some reason. They always make these claims. And that probably did have an effect on some people who bought into the media lies that, you know, regardless of whether Trump's response was, you know, good or bad, you can compare it to Europe. Europe's going under another lockdown again, and they did everything supposedly right according to the public health experts. Yet they're shutting down again. They're having their cases are soaring as well as ours. So you can't really say that this is all Trump's fault when the solutions that like Democrats have is trust the experts, which the experts kept changing their opinion week to week. You know, 1 week they're saying wear a mask, next week they're not saying wear a mask, then they're going back to wearing a mask. And then they're saying, oh, this isn't a big deal. And then a month later, they're like, this is the biggest deal ever. So you really can't, you know, fault Trump for all the COVID devastation, but the media did. And that message certainly reached a lot of people.
Yeah.
So if you really want to blame this, I think it's all, you know, I would really call it COVID disinformation spread by the mainstream media and the election rigging done by elites and corrupt urban machines. This is why, you know, the elections from after election night doesn't look as favorable to Trump. And to look at other explanations, I think is, you know, misses the bigger point.
That's exactly right, because what is the point of, you know, like for Gurdusky or other people who are talking about this 1% that he lost here or a percentage point that he lost there? It's like, why are you talking about this? The reason that you talk about something like this is so that it can be addressed and fixed in the future. But that's not the number one problem right now. The number one problem right now is that the Democrats, through literal ballot box stuffing, through mass media, you know, brainwashing campaigns, through the COVID hoax, through the all of this stuff, they've stolen the election. That's what happens. And so if we can address that and fix it, that should be the messaging. We have to get that into people's awareness so that we can fix this. And then we can start worrying about the finer points of like, oh, how do we shift this percentage of the population towards us? What's the appropriate messaging for this policy? That type of stuff, you know. But for now, the messaging needs to be on the corruption, because if the corruption weren't there, it doesn't matter that we, you know, that Trump maybe didn't do this or that perfectly right. Until then, you know, it's like it doesn't matter. None of it matters.
Yeah, no, and I agree. And for a lot of these same people, you know, this is kind of an aside that is something that we saw the Millie MAGA march, is that a lot of these national populists and a lot of, you know, one of the funny things is there's a strange convergence of you know, National Populism Inc. or Populism Inc. and Wignats on a lot of their takes, even though Populism Inc. is totally horrified by Wignats and would never allow them anywhere near their conferences. But they are sharing a lot of similar takes at the moment. But a lot of them who are these people who are giving up on Trump are really big fans of unions. They think they resist woke capital. However, when we marched down to the area where all the unions are headquartered in DC, they all had Black Lives Matter propaganda displayed on their buildings. So do you really see unions as possible right-wing bastions?
No, I don't. I mean, not at all. I mean, union workers are one thing, but you're not going to win these unions over. You're not. There's a reason that they go the way that they do, and that's become who they are. It's not like they're not like these individual people who see what's happening in the country and just want it to change and want things to go back in the right direction. These unions have become something completely different than that. And it's funny because Republicans used to understand this when they were just like totally anti-union, maybe, you know, even just, you know, dogmatically anti-union, because that's what a Republican believes. But it's like you have to understand that these are not organizations that are, you know, together because they really want to look out for the best interest of their workers. They've become something that is looking out for the best interest of themselves. And the best interest for them right now is to support Black Lives Matter and all of this other like woke stuff. And so there's no hope in trying to win over the actual unions because they are fundamentally against what we are about. And so it's a complete waste of time. We should just instead focus on the issues that are important to the actual individuals and just hope that that it'll get to them and that they'll come along with us.
Yeah, and the popular perception of the unions is that they're representing, that the average union member is this hardworking white steel worker who, you know, he's got like, yeah, he's covered in dust and he's like, he's just been working all day. He's got calluses all over his hands and he's like having a cigarette break and he doesn't have any tolerance for transgender and, you know, Black Lives Matter. But he wants his economic interests represented. And there's certainly a lot of people like that. But the average union member is more likely to be a Black woman who works for the government than this, you know, mythical base. I don't want to call it mythical because these people actually do exist. Than this white, naturally based steel worker. And if you look at this, like only around 6% of the private sector is unionized. Meanwhile, over 30% of the public sector is unionized. And all these unions know that this is where all their growth is and this is what they want to support. And they support all the causes that public sector workers back, which the most base unions, not all unions are bad. I mean, police unions, of course, are good. And so are unions representing Border Patrol and ICE. All the law enforcement unions are based, are usually advocating for good positions. You know, they're fighting for tough crime policies. They're fighting for a wall. If they're the Border Patrol Union, they're willing to support Republican candidates because they know Democrats don't support their interests. You know, those are good public sector unions and probably firefighters as well. But, you know, the people who are, you know, the mail carriers union or whatever, you know, not necessarily these things are, this is really what more people should envision unions as public sector workers who, you know, don't really do any work and have very left-wing positions. And it's no longer the ideal steel worker who, you know, is, you know, socially conservative, but his economic policies lean left. You know, there's those people still exist, but that's not at the forefront of unions. And that's not at the, and that's not the people who are controlling the unions. I mean, the unions typically recruit like these college-educated shitlibs who go in there and they fully believe in BLM, they fully believe in the gender ideology and everything like that. And it's even the most powerful voice in unions, Richard Trumka, who's the head of the AFL-CIO, wrote this horrible op-ed for a gay website about how unions need to acknowledge that Black trans lives matter. And I have to say, it's like, well, how is this different from woke capitalists? You know, they're both on the same side of all these issues. And, you know, they're not really necessarily challenging these, you know, corporate subversion. They're, you know, on the same page with it. And I just think that people, I know some people want to create more unions for other sectors, like, I don't know, like Uber drivers and et cetera. And they think that this would actually be good for right-wing causes. And you, if you've ever met, I mean, maybe you're living in an area where all your Uber drivers are Trump supporters or whatever, but most Uber drivers are immigrants, or even if they're white, they're like huge, like leftists who support Bernie Sanders and will go off on political rants about how like racists are destroying this country and we need to send the FBI after white supremacists and racists are ruining the health industry. And this is what you'll hear from Uber drivers. They're not necessarily people who are going to be open to a national populist message.
Right.
And the point is, if you unionize Uber and Lyft, is like, what's the point of it anymore? It's just a taxi service now.
Exactly. And what do you think will happen? It'll cost more and it'll defeat the entire
purpose. People would be mad about it. I mean, yes, like there should be, you know, the conditions for them are not ideal. Yes, there should be some reforms and, you know, the government looking into that, into helping them out. But at the same time, if you unionize them and you destroy the service, like most Americans would be pissed because Americans like Uber and Lyft. And you can argue maybe they shouldn't, but you're arguing against, you know, you're arguing against a massive wave that's going in the opposite direction. So I don't know if that's necessarily the smartest idea, especially for Republicans. If Republicans, for some reason, decided to unionize Uber drivers, which they're handing them over to a solid left-wing interest group that has never sided with Republicans before and is always advocating for positions that are antithetical to conservatism and right-wing positions, and you're unionizing them to have the end result of something that pisses off the majority of Americans, I don't know if this is necessarily a good political idea.
Yeah. Well, it's like these, it just shows that, like, how well the people who are saying this type of stuff understand like politics, because rather than saying that we're going to get rid of the, you know, old stereotypes of the Republican Party, and we will be willing to incorporate things into our platform which in the past have been associated with the American left or the Democratic Party. And that's one thing. But what these people are saying is, like, we have to appeal to the increasingly left-wing population of the United States. And so we need to just start doing everything that sounds like it would be a Democratic thing and say, well, that's because, you know, like, oh, don't you want to be a Republican now? We support the working class or whatever, because they just don't understand why some of these things are popular. And so they just want to do it with everything, which is stupid. That's a very stupid way to do things, is to start applying blanket solutions to things. Not even solutions. This is not even a solution. There's not necessarily a problem with this. Of course, it should be maybe a little bit different, but it's not like there's a problem and the solution is unionizing Uber drivers or, you know, whatever other industry.
Yeah, and you made a good point there about how Republicans are trying to steal left-wing talking points and pretend that the Republican talking points. It's like the Destiny Right has been talking about this for years and years and like saying that like Democrats are the real racists, but they're really revving up these talking points in the wake of the 2020 election. And it's not just national populists who are trying to do this and, you know, trying to turn the flip on unions and claim that they're actually secret conservative bastions. Is that establishment Republicans are already trying to brag about a more inclusive GOP. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy tweeted this week. 12 Democrat incumbents lost their re-election to the House. Every one of them lost to a Republican woman, minority, and our veteran. Hey, you're a veteran. You should run. Back to the quote. The Republican Party is stronger because of our diversity. Funny enough, McCarthy said around 3 years ago that diversity was not a strength for America. So what's changed here for Kevin McCarthy?
Oh, sorry about that. Sorry, my mic was muted somehow. I don't know why. I don't think that anything has actually really changed for Kevin McCarthy. I think that what's changed is just his perception of the American demographic situation and the American social situation. And rather than thinking, okay, well, perhaps we should use our influence or our authority or whatever to push things in the right direction, they just say, okay, well, we'll just follow along with whatever the Democrats are doing and try to siphon off their voters along the way. I think that that's all that's changed over the past 4 years, because there's definitely nothing that is changed as far as, like, does diversity of any kind really, like, make anything more strong? No, we've only seen the opposite, and that's continued to prove true. So I think all that could change is just the party line, as far as, like, okay, things are getting really bad. I guess we got to, you know, start pandering to, you know, the multi-ethnic section of America.
Yeah, and one of the reasons that Kevin McCarthy probably criticized diversity 2 or 3 years ago is he thought that Trumpism was the wave of the future, and they knew, and he was like seeing all these critiques of people who were around Trump that they were saying like diversity is not a strength. He was seeing what Stephen Miller was saying in public, that he's like, oh, I have to move to this position in order to strengthen myself. And he was also looking to become the next Speaker of the House after Paul Ryan retired in 2018. Of course, they lost the House, so he didn't become House Speaker. He just stuck as the House GOP caucus leader. So he thought that that was the way to go now. And now he's like trying to shift it. They're like, oh, wow, Trump did so well among Blacks and Hispanics that this is like a diverse and more inclusive GOP. And we have to work and celebrate diversity, when in fact that all these people gravitated towards Trump because of his machismo, over him acting as a strong man and him standing up to leftists and liberals, especially among Hispanics. I think that they voted for Trump because he was the one candidate who is not overwhelmingly in favor of Black Lives Matter. He was not the one bending the knee and being like, we need to have like every day is a holiday to celebrate Black Lives Matter. And a lot of Hispanics like, yeah, I'll go for that. It wasn't necessarily them being won over by the Republicans' economic agenda couched in inclusive language. They just saw him as a cool, strong man who is standing up to liberals and Black Lives Matter, and that's why they voted for him. I mean, with Blacks, it's a little bit slightly different. Obviously, I mean, many of them probably don't have as negative of an attitude towards Black Lives Matter and the riots as Hispanics do, but it's not necessarily what Kevin McCarthy and the GOP establishment is going to be offering these people in the next 4 years, when they think that they, barring Trump not securing this election, that they can just ditch Trump and ignore him and pretend that he never existed and just move along back to their old form. You know, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. I mean, they were gravitated towards Trump because he presented this WWE culture, this brash, in-your-face, populist attitude that was taking on the elites and taking on these leftists who wanted to impose political correctness on you. He was not, you know, giving a politically correct message to Hispanics that the GOP establishment wants, that they shore off all the rudeness and the not and lack of niceties, and they just say, oh, well, we love Hispanics and immigration is what made our country, so is diversity. No, Trump just, you know, offered a cool song in Spanish and, you know, offered them, you know, opportunities through his own agenda, and they gravitated towards that, and they liked that. And I don't think the GOP establishment got that message.
No, they didn't. The thing about, you know, in politics, it's always about what works. You know, of course, you have to have the right goal and stuff. But as far as getting there, you have to go with what works within the world, or within the bounds of morality and what is ethical. The problem with people in the GOP is that, yes, in some cases, they're compromised by lobbyists or, you know, whatever other special interests and money they're getting. But ultimately, they're just really stupid people, and they don't understand what actually works. So they see this stuff that's going on now, and they think, okay, so the diversity and the racial stuff and the, you know, the social, the leftward social issues, that works. So we should embrace that. But that's not what they're not seeing, what's really there. They're just really stupid. And that's why they've been pandering the way they have to Hispanics for so long. And then Trump comes along and doesn't pander to them and does what's right, and Hispanics love it. And the GOP is so stupid that they can't even see that. And they're just like, oh, so what we were doing all along really does work. We just have to pander more.
It was all inclusive language, yeah. I mean, yeah, the GOP's grand strategy for winning Hispanics after the 2012 election was amnesty. And Trump's whole political brand is about resisting illegal immigrants and deporting them and building a wall. And apparently this message, you know, really attracted far more Hispanics now than the amnesty plan that they proposed in 2013. And I think one good thing is that the GOP has gotten the message that amnesty doesn't work, that they can, there's other ways of winning over Hispanic voters, which is good. I don't think if Biden becomes president, he'll have any chance of passing a type of Gang of Eight amnesty for a couple of reasons. One, the left is so far left now that they will not tolerate any additional security measures. Like what Obama offered in 2013, it was like increased border security and increased deportations and tougher penalties for those who come after the amnesty. But now they would like say, no, we're not going to have any of that. We're just a straight legalization for all these people. And we tear down any barriers to more people coming here. And that's our final position. Anything more than anything that counters that is white supremacy. And so, and Biden is like so weak and subservient to the left. I mean, he's senile. He doesn't know what to do. So he's going to obviously cater to them. And the right is not, most of the right at least, realizes that this is a stupid idea. It doesn't win over Hispanics. They just did the best among Hispanics since George W. Bush, and who pandered them far more than Trump did. And Trump, you know, was like number one message was opposing illegal immigration. And I think they're going to finally, I think at least on this front, they're finally getting that message. I don't think we're going to see the kind of quote unquote comprehensive immigration reform that legalizes at least 11 million illegals. It likely legalize at least double that. I don't think we're going to see that anytime soon. Thankfully, based on the election results we saw in 2020.
Yeah. And I don't think so either. I think that's good. And I mean, you know, Trump won, but even if they steal it from him, it still looks like the Senate is there and stuff. So like you said, I mean, I think that that most of the Republican Party would still resist that type of, you know, just blanket amnesty, total immigration revolution that the left wants nowadays.
Yeah, and they would. The difference is in 2013, the Republicans didn't have the majority in the Senate.
Right.
They're going to retain it. I think they would win both Georgia runoffs. Purdue nearly won. It was only a few, like 0.3 points off from getting the 50% on election day. And this Warnock guy, who the Reverend is so radical that there's no way Georgia will vote for him. So they'll probably have 52 senators, which is good and bad with that. But that is certainly a topic for another episode. But moving on to our highly respected Patreon questions. As a reminder, you too can get this power if you sign up for the Patreon option at highly respected's Patreon page. This one comes from Dave. He asks, what's your thoughts on those who say we should give up on Trump and look to Tucker? Now, a lot of people have made this point, and even I've probably made it on Twitter, is that, you know, Tucker may be the real successor to Trump, overall, that, you know, he's somebody who's firmly committed to these ideas. This is somebody who can properly articulate them. He does it every night on Fox News. He's the number one cable news host. I think his numbers are even over 5 million viewers now, even though it's probably had a decline following Fox News's terrible post-election coverage. But he's still the number one rated cable news host. So he already has that popularity. He's clearly Republican voters and a lot of independents, you know, like his message. They like his, you know, populist style. And he's able to more intellectually articulate it than Trump. There is that potential there. But there are some issues with, you know, Tucker replacing Trump. First off, we don't know how this is all going to crumble overall with the election results and the challenges. But let's say that Trump loses, which he didn't lose. It got stolen from him. But let's say he loses the challenge to the election. You know, he's not going to go away, and he's still going to have most of the base is still going to like him more than Tucker. They like Tucker a lot. But if they had to choose, they would go with Trump. And Trump is still going to have this great myth around him that he won the 2020 election, but it was stolen from him by the globalist elite. And this is a very powerful narrative that most of his voters believe. I mean, I think, you know, among the polls, I think it's like 3/4 of Republicans believe the election was rigged. Which is a high, very high number, and those people are not likely to change their opinions anytime soon. So there's that. I also think that Tucker would have a tougher time going from, you know, essentially what is a journalist role as a cable news host to becoming a politician. He's not. Politicians in some way have to believe their own bullshit. They have to fully, you know, they can't display cynicism, and they really have to, you know, be committed to their line. Tucker is very much like most journalists, you know, they're willing to what they really can't go along with certain things that a politician can, that they commit to this narrative, that they commit to this line. He's a little too, you know, he would be like, I don't want to really believe this. I'm not going to say this. And even though he needs to say that as a politician. I also think that he doesn't want to be president. I think he really likes the job he's doing now. And I think besides being president, there's nothing, you know, more important than what he's doing now. I mean, he's reaching, as I was saying, 5 million people a night, and he's pushing them in a nationalist direction. So why would he run for president? And I also think that, you know, some people always complain about Trump's personnel, is that I think Tucker would have the same, you know, if he even became president, he would have the same personnel decisions, because he really likes being friends with everyone. And, you know, there would probably be people who are running his administration who hold views that are directly counter to what he believes in the same way that happened with Trump's administration. And also, I think he would be really weighed down by the burdens of the presidency compared to Trump, is that Trump, everyone always likes to remark that he has not aged at all from the presidency, probably because a lot of these things just don't seem to bother him and other people. I mean, there's something concerning about that, maybe for normal people, but you almost want your leader to be like that, that they're like, you know, soldiers died. He realizes that's a bad thing, and he's able to express empathy to that family. But he's able to go to sleep at night, not necessarily comforted or anything like that, but he's able to accept these burdens and to, you know, go along. And I don't think, you know, and for like most people, and especially people who have not been in politics all their lives, I mean, politicians are, you know, wired a little differently, especially if you see Republicans, you know, they're all robotic and they stick to this. You know, Tucker would be very bothered by a lot of those burdens, and he would absolutely hate it. And in a way that Trump has just kind of accepted it, you know, he's, you know, focused on tweeting and Fox, whatever Fox News hosts are saying about them. And, you know, maybe you want that leader, but if it's some leader who's really weighed down by these burdens, they're not necessarily going to be as effective as, you know, Trump. And Trump, for whatever it is the best that we have right now. You know, there is no real successor to Trump. I mean, if Tucker, you know, if, you know, however this depends, you know, Trump, you know, let's say Trump loses his election challenge. He stays politically active, but he decides not to run again. And Tucker decides to run again. Tucker would obviously be the best presidential candidate. But I think people who think that he would be infinitely superior to Trump, he would have many of the same weaknesses and new weaknesses with the territory. And what he's doing right now is incredibly invaluable. And I don't know if he'd want to give it up. So. That's my thoughts on Tucker.
I agree with that. And I think that, you know, the thing is that you can't abandon Trump, or you can't say, okay, Trump is not working, we have to go to Tucker. Because the reason that Tucker is working is because of Trump. I mean, Tucker is very skilled, and he's charismatic, and he's great at what he does in general. But were it not for Trump, nothing would have transpired that needed to happen in order for us to be in this place where Tucker is the number one cable news event on, you know, in history. And so, number one, you can't abandon Trump and go with Tucker, because Tucker is an extension of Trump in a sense, at least as far as this stuff goes. And so
I don't know if I would say his popularity is dependent on the Trump moment, and he's been able to articulate Trumpism in a way that Trump couldn't, but that right, at the that's end what of the day, I, yeah. The source is Trump.
Right. And so, and I think that's important. I also think that as far as who can draw, you know, who can draw the biggest crowd, who can get the most votes and stuff, that's Trump. And so even if you say that Tucker is the second best thing, so long as Trump is available, so long as Trump isn't, you know, restricted by constitutional amendments and stuff to prevent him from running, we have to support Trump. He's the man. He's the guy. He's number one. And, you know, if it gets to the point where, you know, for whatever reason he leaves office, then and he can't re-enter office, then at that point, then that option's off the table. And then we go with somebody like Tucker if he wants it. He may never want it. And, you know, and that might be for the best. Who knows? We don't know. But that comes after Trump. That comes after Trump is out for whatever reason permanently. And that's what I think.
For right now, it's Trump. And, you know, whatever his faults, and a lot of people are like, well, you know, Tucker is much better at articulating this. And yes. But at the end of the day, you want that from a cable news host, but from a politician, you want maybe want something of a different. And yes, it's one of the main things that has like been frustrating with Trump is like there's so many opportunities where he can articulate an incredible nationalist argument, and he's just Trump and he just fumbles it. I think one of the best examples is that at one of the presidential debates when he's talking about critical race theory, he was so close to saying that this is racism towards white people, that this is anti-white racism, which would have been such a powerful argument and true argument, but he was just like fumbling around. It's like, this is racist. This is Marxist. It's really bad. They're terrible things. And it's just like, it was so close. And he always does this in a lot of his statements. But at the same time, he does understand that these arguments are powerful, that these cultural and identity issues are really what animates the base. Tucker also understands that. But Tucker, you know, he's very much more of a journalist than a politician, which, you know, that presents many better opportunities as being, you know, cable news host. But when you transition, you know, I think it would be a tough transition. I don't think he wants it. I mean, I think he would consider it. But the one concerning factor is that he would give up on Trump entirely, and they would become Trump and Tucker would go at loggerheads because Tucker may support another candidate for 2024, say, you know, a Josh Hawley. Which is somebody he likes a lot, which, you know, I'm almost never Hawley, but I don't think Hawley could ever win a Republican primary. So I don't necessarily need to worry about it too much, but that's somebody he would promote.
Well, and with
and,
Tucker,
if they came into conflict, barring whatever happens. I mean, you know, there could be some circumstances we don't see. Maybe Trump gets totally controlled by Ivanka and Jared and goes in a horrible direction. I don't think that's likely, but there is a small chance that could happen. And maybe Tucker is the more base person, but from this perspective, you know, how to choose, you know, who is the leader, I would say it's still Trump. And, you know, Tucker is a leader, but he's not the leader.
Right. And I think, you know, it's possible, you kind of alluded to this, but it's possible that, you know, in Trump right now, we have somebody who, you know, he does a lot of great stuff. He has a lot of great, you know, positions, but he can't articulate the finer details very well. In Tucker, we might have, you know, almost the alternative where he's very good at articulating what we want to say. He's very good at communicating the ideas, but maybe he can't execute it, or maybe he can't carry the responsibilities in certain ways. And so it might not be, you know, the grass might not be totally greener on the other side. It might be its own issue.
Exactly. And I actually think that. I think he, as I was saying earlier, I think the burdens of the office and as a politician would weigh incredibly heavily on him, as it would with most people. I mean, if you're thrust into this and you're entrusted with these decisions that affect the lives of millions and could end up with people getting killed and hurt, and if you're being blamed for, you know, people getting killed or hurt, or, you know, the misfortunes of these people, you know, a lot of people don't want to take that burden. I mean, that's why the office ages so many people, with the exception of Donald Trump. But you almost want that person. Like, that's actually one of the things I most respect about Trump, is he's just somebody who, you know, he's able to display the empathy that he needs with these people. You know, if they're suffering tremendous loss, like any person who's ever met with him, they're like, you know, Trump really showed like he cared. He really understood my pain. He was somebody who could display the empathy, but at the same time, you know, he's not letting it wear him down. Like, he's able to accept these responsibilities, regardless of how goofy he is. That is a quality about him. And I think that's something you can't overlook, because a national populace is going to have to make incredibly tough decisions. That's going to make the entirety of Washington, D.C. hate him. Old friends hate him. Everyone calling him a fascist, you know, people issuing death threats against his family and friends. And it requires such a strong backbone to do that, you know, it's going to be really tough for any person to do this. And, you know, Trump is not necessarily perfect. Maybe there's certainly a mythical ideal you would rather have. But this is all we have at the moment, and, you know, you have to stand by it unless circumstances changes. So for right now, Trump's the leader, and that's the end of the story. So on that note, I think we're out of time today. But Jake, tell the good people how to follow you.
Okay, well, you can follow me on Twitter. My at is at Jacob C. Lloyd. You can follow me there. And if you follow me there, you'll find me just about everywhere else on the social media stuff. But you can watch my stream every day in the afternoon, in the later afternoon, at dlive.tv/JakeLloyd.
Awesome. So make sure to give him a follow. And follow his great takes. I hear about this DLive. I hear the kids play video games on there and talk politics. I don't know really know what DLive is. If I had a DLive, I don't know what I'd do. I like listen, read a book maybe with the kids, you know, show pictures, like read it. It's like, hey, you know, it's like a kindergarten teacher, but some massive tome. And it's like, look, don't you see that? It's a picture. So maybe I could do that. Maybe we'll think about that. But anyway, Jake, thanks for being on. It's always great to hear from you.
Thank you very much. It's always great to be on Highly Respected with Scott Greer.
Oh, absolutely it is. And you're welcome. And until next time, stay respected.